You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the 32nd edition of the Center Steer Podcast. I'm John Costage, your host here in wonderful southwestern Pennsylvania. It is the Thanksgiving weekend here in the United States of America, and we are thankful for all our listeners. I want to thank you for listening, for you tweeting, for your likes and favorites, and so that's always interesting to us and nice to hear when folks reach out to us. And
thankful for that well-paying job here at the podcast.
Oh, yeah, it pays. It pays. It pays in nothing. Yes. Yeah, there is no payment for the podcasting job.
In case you are wondering.
I'm joined in studio today with...
I'm Harold.
And Harold is our only panelist today. Everyone else is busy. As we enter the holiday season here, it can be difficult to assemble the full crack panelist team.
And since I have no life, I showed up.
No, you're required to be here. You get paid well to be here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. You haven't seen the bill yet.
True. The bill, the friendship bill.
Among others.
So it is December, and we are entering the final month of Defender production. And we have nothing planned for the podcast for that. I just would like to remind everybody that this is the final month of the Defender production, the final days for the Defender as we know it.
Have a moment of silence.
I think we should. And we'll have a moment of silence.
Lasting 96 minutes.
Good, good. I like that. Or maybe 40, what are we up to now? 50, 60, no, 62 minutes, 62 years, right?
67, I believe.
Is it that long? Oh, you're
1948.
48. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're right. Oh, we're getting that. Wow. Yeah, that's right. 67
Considering
years.
Considering that the folks at the Green Oval consider that to be one contiguous model, that is one hell of a product run.
Absolutely. So I think, yeah, maybe we'll do 67 seconds of silence. I'll add that in later. Or maybe what they should put together is 67 seconds of each model engine running. That might be something cool to do, if I could track down all the engines from all the different models and put them all together. There's something to work on, huh?
I might come close to one of each, but probably none of them run, so.
That's true. Well, there you go.
Junk on my pile.
That would be, hence, silence.
Hence the silence, yes. We'll now start up the next one.
I also remind you that we're part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I want to thank Dan for letting me participate in his recent show, which was the Holiday Gift Guide. So head out over to the 4x4 Podcast, which is part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and you can listen to all the hosts of the network talking about the Holiday Gift Guide for off-roading, overlanding, and models, and all the different models. So. I recommended, this should be no surprise to anybody, my big recommendation was getting Rover's Magazine for free, because it's free.
Yeah, the price is right.
Absolutely, yeah, it was great.
And the pictures are good, the stories are good, obviously the suggestions for gifts and parts and stuff are nice too, but just for the stories and pictures, it's worth it.
Yeah, and it's a good coverage of all models and all makes, so for
lifestyle is not brand specific.
Indeed, that's true. Exactly. And if you're looking to buy something for the Land Rover person in your life, that's a good place to start. Even if it's you're not in the United States, it gives you some ideas of maybe some things you might want to be able to purchase, if you're such inclined. So why don't we go ahead and move into the news then? First up, JLR reports U.S. sales for October of 2015 were up very, very strong. It is their best sales month ever. They were up 76% in October, and they sold 8,187 units. And this is their best October sales month ever. Land Rover was up itself 98% for the month. Sales basically driven by the Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport. And they are celebrating a record-breaking Land Rover sales month. on the Jag side, the F-Type had its best October sales month ever, with sales up 17% for the month. Although overall, Jag was down a little bit, I think 4%, if I'm not mistaken. 2% for the month, I think 5% for the year. Land Rover, though, had record-breaking sales month, as I indicated. Why are they saying now 7,100 total units sold in the month? Oh, that's interesting. Oh, that must be both brands hit 8,187 units at Jag and Land Rover. And then Land Rover itself sold 7,199 units for the month. The Range Rover, Range Rover Sport, and the Evoque had their best sales month ever, up 46%, 77%, and 28% respectively for all of those.
It's interesting, the numbers you're quoting show just how strong the Land Rover brand is relative to the Jaguar brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's just...
Does it talk any about the relative strength of Range Rover versus Land Rover?
You'd have to kind of infer that on your own. We'd have to look at the numbers
and do the math and do some
analysis. They do give units. The Range Rover itself was at 1803, Sport 1906, and Evoque 1265 in units. The Discovery Sport was at 1356 units, which, if you look at the numbers, puts it more than the Evoque, but less than both of the Rangies.
Yeah.
And the LR4 had its best sales month since December of 2010, but they don't give any units there for that one. And that's pretty much it for the sales here in the United States.
Yeah, it sounds like it's about 60% Range Rover, though, from what you're just doing the quick math in my head.
Are you including Evoque?
Yeah.
That whole family, then?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's fine. So that's... Yeah, sales are doing well. Although with sales in the U.S. doing well, they're not doing all that well in China. They were down, I believe, I'm trying to scan here quickly for the number, I think it was down like 36%.
Well, how much of that was because of that fire at the dock that burned them all?
I don't see that talked about in here, but there's been a general... Well,
because that created a tremendous supply problem. I would think that would impact the sales.
Yeah, well, they let's see here. There has been a general downturn in the Chinese economy, including the auto market,
sure,
too. And sales, they say here that volume dropped 32% in the third quarter for Jag in China. But they are, and for part of that, plus other reasons which are kind of unclear and murky, JLR is going to cut $6.8 billion in costs over the next several years, and they went up at the same time, pushing production to 1 million vehicles under a secret project called Leap 4.5.
Funny number.
I get the Leap. I mean, the 4.5. Unless maybe there's a previous one, and this is like the strategic goal refinement for this one, and they did a half year change or something. Who knows? But they don't want to lay anybody off. They're not going to impact into the research budget or a couple of the plants that they've opened up, the Brazil plant or the proposed Slovakia plant. Those would not be affected by this. So obviously this being a secret project, and it seems to have been leaked to the press, Reuters in particular. There's no details on everything that's going to completely happen, but apparently this is a...
They'll pick up some of that savings by their increasing production. You get economy of scale, because if you're making twice as many, it costs you less per unit to make.
Right. Oh, there is one stat here. To your point, is they are going to find savings by underpinning more models with modular platforms and by adjusting the supply chain.
Right. Leylandize the fleet.
Yes. Well, I guess the plan there would be to spread that across JLR in particular. So hence, I guess, the new F-Pace. Does it have the underpinnings of the Evoque, we believe?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, the more parts in common you have, the smaller the parts bin has to be, because you're using the same stuff on everything, and so you're buying more quantity of fewer things. It saves you a ton of money.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. Cool. So, JLR looking to cut costs over the next time. But meanwhile, they also want to double the size of its engine plant. So they built that new engine plant in the UK we're at. I forget where it's located. My apologies there.
Well, if they want to make twice as many vehicles, they need twice as many engines, right?
Indeed. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because their current volume is something short of 500,000 units. So, yeah, they want to double that to 1 million in the next several years. So
you'd need double the engines.
So they're going to invest $450 million to expand its engineer manufacturing center.
That's a lot of money.
That is. Well, that's also a drop in a bucket compared to what they want to save and how much they put into their R&D budget is like £4.5 million, I think.
Right.
Or $4.5 million. Let me check on that one. $4.5 billion annual research budget. And apparently they're going to save also a little bit of money by not going to the Detroit Auto Show next year in 2016. So in 2016, they have said that they want to, Autoblog says this is not their quote, not a quote from JLR, but says they want to shift its focus to other international shows instead. So they don't want to attend the 2016 Detroit Auto Show. Quote, here's the quote. Following a review of our global consumer engagement program, the decision has been made not to exhibit at the Detroit show in 2016. They are going to go to Chicago, New York, LA, plus Geneva, Frankfurt, Paris, Beijing, and Shanghai.
Yeah, I get the rationale behind all the European and Chinese shows. I'm curious to know if they want to shave one show off their North American tour, why it would be Detroit.
Yeah, not sure. Yeah, last year they revealed the name of the F-Pace, and they also announced the diesel versions of Land Rover last year at that show. They've been doing a lot in the last this past year. Maybe they're taking just a break for a month or two.
I guess maybe strategically they might be thinking, since Detroit's kind of early in the season, they might sort of hang back and have another bomb to drop later in the season versus their competition.
Right. Well, yeah. Interesting. Because the show takes place in mid-January, does it not?
It's February.
No, I think it's January. I actually have some friends that they...
I know it's in the part of winter when you least want to be in Detroit.
Yeah, which would be January, pretty much. Yeah, I have some friends, they'll day trip it up because, it's not that far away from where we are. And they'll go up and visit the show and then drive back the same day. And so I think it's mid-January is when that show typically is. Speaking of Land Rover at shows, this is actually a bad segue because this has nothing to do with it. But the new Range Rover Evoque convertible has debuted since the last time we talked to you on the podcast. There was a lot of announcement, a lot of made about it. Very interesting vehicle, I think.
It ticks all the boxes for you. It's a convertible and it's a Freelander.
Well, it has that Freelander feel.
It's a Freelander.
To it.
Get over it.
I have nothing to get over. You have to get over the fact that it's a Freelander. I still enjoy the mighty Freelander.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's this fantastic. Vehicle is it for you. It's a Freelander and it's a ragtop.
It's a ragtop. Yes. Literally, it is, in fact, a ragtop. It has a fabric acoustic Z-fold top that will come down in 18 seconds up to speeds of 30 miles an hour.
Well, the question is whether it goes back up again.
And how long it'll continue to do that.
Right.
Does it get stuck in the down position while you're,
in classic British form, stuck halfway in the middle somewhere.
Oh, that'd be interesting. Yeah, down the road, it just stops. Yeah, well, they've gotten better with the reliability, so hopefully that...
They couldn't have gotten worse.
Good point. So it's an interesting vehicle. The things I've seen, people either love it or hate it. I think they did a nice job. I think it looks good. It's distinctive. And, as we had mentioned earlier in the news, 80% of... No, we didn't mention that yet. We were just talking about that. That's that there was an interview with on Top Gear magazine with Jerry McGovern, who's the Land Rover design director and chief creative officer. Apparently, I didn't know they had a chief creative officer. And he talked about why they asked him about creating the Evoque convertible. And one of the interesting things he had mentioned out of this, and we'll talk about this in more length in a minute, but he said that 80% of Evoque buyers have never owned a Land Rover before. So this is an entry model. They're bringing people in.
Once again, it's the Freelander of the fleet.
Woohoo!
That was the Freelander's function, too, to bring people into the brand.
Yeah, have a cheaper, smaller model that got people introduced to it, and hopefully they move into the family and start working their way up as they get older and have other needs.
For those who have never had a truck before and have only had cars, it was more familiar to them.
Right, yes.
Because it was a car, it wasn't a truck.
Right. And that's basically what the Evoque is, too.
Right.
Yeah. Well, or as they call them now, crossovers.
Yeah, which questions the in my mind questions the sensibility of cutting the roof off and taking away any strength you might have.
Well, I mean, they certainly address that. I mean, they're not, you know, that unreasonable that they're not going to put the strength in there. And it has that, you know, of course it has that safety bar that will come up if the car does in fact roll over. But yeah.
Well, and I question how strong and how stiff it is off road.
Well, they did take it off road, and there is an article here talking about taking it off road, and was this the one? Yeah, this was on BBC Auto, and no, that was not the one. I apologize. Different article. Get my business together here. This was an auto car. They took it off road, and they seem to enjoy it.
That's fine. You can do it once or twice. The question is, two or three years down the road, is it going to flex itself to death?
Yeah, I suppose.
The problem is there's no frame. It's unibody.
Right.
And with a unibody, you need that roof. And it's one thing to do it in a car that's only on the road. When you go off-road, it puts a lot of extra stress into the chassis. And you can reinforce the heck out of it, but you may still not be good enough.
Right.
So I'm curious to see how they addressed it, number one, and how well it actually holds up.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm sure also that in their minds... Well, here we go. Land Rover's been able to build more rigidity into the Evoque convertible via chassis bracing and strengthening, although this has come with a weight penalty that pushes the car towards the 2-ton mark.
But, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm
negating any benefit of making it not body on frame.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sure they took into account that aspect of... Because, you know, looking at how often people take their vehicle off-road, how often do people take their vehicle off-road, let alone take this specific vehicle off-road?
So because anybody who's serious about going off-road isn't going to buy one of these anyway.
Hopefully they're not.
And for all the reasons we've discussed.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, as far as the weight penalty is concerned, that's the problem behind any convertible. Any car you take and saw the roof off and then try to put the strength back into it, you add 400, 500, 600 pounds easily.
Yeah,
they all do it.
Right, exactly. So that's the new Evoque convertible is out and available for sales. Has some they have a nice 8-minute video on all the features about it. We'll have a link in the show notes to that if you want to check that out. It has all the glitz and glamour that is modern vehicles with has a lane departure warning. It'll even it detects if you're drowsy or not because it will tell you. It'll nudge the steering wheel back to keep the car in lane if it feels that you're drifting out of the lane. So it'll just actually turn the car for you, which is kind of kind of cool in a way. And then there's a T-brake light they've added to the dash with a T-brake light. Well, that's what I'm calling it, the T-brake light. So if the car thinks it's sensing that you're drowsy, then the tea light looks like a coffee cup, but I'm calling it a tea light, will pop on and suggest that you take a break. And then it has a heads-up display and all sorts of, you know, baubles and things that go on with that. So check it out, and we'll have links to the show note if you haven't seen it already. But I'm sure many of our listeners already have, I'm suspecting. But interestingly, and we mentioned this just a few moments ago about the design, Land Rover's design chief discussing about the Evoque convertible. And so it's a couple interesting things I think we should probably talk about here. Is so Top Gear asked him, you know, why a convertible? And Jerry says that by 2020, there will be 20 million SUVs sold globally, but the market is fragmenting, so there'll be different niches within that. As a business, we have to go get a critical mass of volume to sustain ourselves and reinvest in our products. So this goes to
looking for more niches to penetrate.
Right. And also, and to hit that now that we know that they have this 1 million sales mark over time, you know, that's that kind of reinforces his, I think, that point there.
Right. In order to sell more, you have to sell in different places.
Sell in different places and have a varying types of models for all different kind of buyers.
Right.
So, yeah, exactly. So this was, and I already had mentioned this, but I want to bring it out again. You know, he says that the Cabrio has a halo effect on the Evoque, which brings more customers to all Evoques. And repeating this, but already 80% of Evoque buyers have never owned a Land Rover before. So that's an interesting stat, I think, from this whole article was that one about how Evoques are bringing people into Land Rover.
Right, and the convertible is even flashier looking, and it brings people to the stores to look at them, and then they'll buy something else.
Right. And then maybe, and then after that, they might buy a different one. You know, well, they move up.
That was the rationale behind the Corvette.
Yeah.
Bring people to Chevrolet stores.
Right. Yeah. Which I'm sure was a rationale for the Mustang, too. And, you know, to get people in, you know, something flashy. Something
the early Mustangs were actually affordable.
True. Well, yeah.
Well, they had versions that were, at least.
Right. Right. And I think even the Corvette, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Not so much, but sort of, yeah.
He said the Evoque is brought to design to the forefront. This is something I think you and I will agree to disagree with him on. Its design plays a fundamental role in starting the massive culture change in our business, making our engineers realize you can have great design and engineering integrity. You do that, and you're going to clean up. This is the point. Design leadership and engineering integrity underpin all new Land Rovers. This is quoting Jerry. That's a bit of a change because design hasn't always been a prerequisite of Land Rovers. Land Rovers of old looked the way they did because of what they did.
Well, that depends on how you define the word design. If you define it as style and flash, then yeah, probably he's right. But what I'm getting from this is that his belief is that you start with fashion and work your way backwards to function.
Hmm. Very possible, yeah. I didn't. I can see why you think that. I'm not so sure he would probably agree with that, but it's very possible.
Probably not, because he thinks he's right.
Well, I guess...
And he's in charge, so we're going to have to buckle up and put up with it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and he's brought new people in with the design he has with the Evoque, so there's new people buying, and sales are up, especially in the U.S., like gangbusters, so I'm sure he's doing something correct.
Right, well...
Something I think you and I will agree with him on is they asked him about the Evoque convertible. Is quite a simple name, and you know why weren't you tempted to create your own word like Jaguar christening the XF Estate Sport Break? And his response was create a word. No, there's always a debate about whether you should give a car a name or a number. For me, people have names, not numbers, and and so should cars. I completely agree. Well, I like the names.
Mind you, cars have had numbers for models for decades as well. It's nothing new. Even your beloved Oldsmobile had several.
Oh, absolutely. But that's not the primary name. You know, it was a Cutlass to begin with.
Well, but they had some. They had the F-85 that was just the F-85.
And they had the 442, and I get all that. But I still generally agree the car should have names. You even tag a number on the end, that's fine.
But I prefer names, too, but I'm saying numbers are nothing new.
Yeah, true. But these
and when they, you know, early days, they had just letters.
And yes, and there's also entire whole makes that all they are numbers. You know, RX this and the 16 that and the ZZ this, and you're like, there's nothing to hang your hat on.
Well, and when they start stacking up the extra letters to denote trim packages, that bugs me.
BMW, talking about BMW.
Well, for one, I was thinking actually. Some of the Japanese companies.
Oh well, yeah, they do that. Well, and BMW does that with putting X's and I's and ILs and all sorts of things on the end, and then you have to, what the number itself tells you the size of the model, the model designation, and then the size, the displacement of the engine, which may not in fact be true, but
yeah, I get the theory behind that.
Yeah, I get the theory, but yeah, I don't. Can't hang your head on a 3 Series. I'm like, doesn't sound right. That's me. So that was the Evoque news. If any of our listeners buy one, certainly like to hear from you. See what it's like, see if you enjoy it. Can you truly put the top down up to 30 miles an hour in 18 seconds? Hit one button and it goes down. That doesn't excite you, does it?
No. 18 seconds is not fast.
No, but at least you can do it at speed. You know, if you're in your Series 3 and you want to put the sides up and go into some sort of convertible mode, you know, it's what? It takes me about 10 minutes.
Well, yeah.
As I mentioned...
Series 3s don't do anything fast. So.
No, they don't. no. As I mentioned, we're coming up on December, the last month of the Defender production ever, as we know it. And there's been a little bit of a mystery going on in London. Land Rover Owner International reports that there's been a black D90 with a taxi light on top, driven by none other than Roger Cranthorne. And it's not legal. You can't actually take a taxi ride. It's not approved to be a taxi or anything. But it has been...
I bet if you jumped in, he'd take you somewhere.
He may. He may, in fact. It's been spotted several times, a lot of pictures. It was also spotted in front of Bonham's, the car auctioneer. And there's some thinking that this may have something to do with the lead-up to the auctioning of the 2 millionth Defender that they're going to be doing in December. And there's some indication that maybe December 8th is some announcement coming up. So maybe that taxi has something to do with it. This might be some sort of PR publicity stunt.
Interesting. I'm not sure what the significance of the taxi light on it would be then at that point, other than just to draw attention to it. It seems to me you could do that in any number of different ways. But.
Right, yeah, exactly. Well, they did that one with that Paul Smith. Not my cousin. I have a cousin, Paul Smith, and an uncle, Paul Smith. But the design.
Paul Smith is a well-known designer over in Europe, so that makes sense.
Exactly. And
although what he did has been done to death by every Land Rover owner who's tried to keep one on the road.
Yeah, but he spent his design time and effort on that. He swapped together different colored panels in different places.
Yeah.
I know.
I can do that
for free.
That happens
to us naturally.
Yeah.
We just do it on our own.
Yeah.
My cousin gets will get tweets all the time for people thinking that he's the Paul Smith, the designer, and he's not. So maybe December 8th. Hopefully we'll get the podcast out in time, and before that happens, and we'll learn what. In addition to that, we'll learn what's going on with this taxi version of the D90.
Yeah, because it doesn't exactly look like the classic black cab or anything.
No, not at all. In addition to the taxi that's out there, that's a mystery, this one's not a mystery, though, and the magazine Pistonheads did a test drive of the Land Rover Defender 110 Heritage Edition, which is, you know, one of the three Heritage, one of the three, Celebration Series, they call it, that are going on. And they generally enjoyed it, but of course they liked it for what it is, which is kind of an old style car, and they're ready. They're also
that could be said of any 110, I would think.
Yes, exactly. True. But yeah, this article is not for. This article is really
clearly not for those in the know.
Not for those in the know. Not for those of us who enjoy it. This is one for someone who's heard about vaguely. There's a Defender out there, and what's that all about? This one's like, yeah, this is old tech. It's interesting. People like it. It's iconic, but it's going away because, you know, it's too hard to maintain and keep up with the regulations, and it's just in its time. So that's what it is. But I enjoyed the one quote they had in here, and I need to find it quickly while I'm talking to you. Oh, here it is. They were talking about the three different Celebration Series. So there's the Heritage, the Adventure, and the Autobiography. And he said, the Heritage is definitely the best of the three. We've not driven the other two, but it just is. I just like that that dry kind of British wit.
Well, you know, if money and legislation would allow, I would have a short wheelbase Heritage Edition and a long wheelbase Adventure Edition, because I think that would be the ultimate combination.
So what's the difference between the different ones?
Well, the Heritage Edition comes in that nifty pastel green paint that the old Series 2s and 3s came in, and it looks very much the old style Land Rover, and I think that the iconic look for that is the short wheelbase. The Adventure Edition looks a lot like the G4 Challenge cars. And the 110s, of course, were the chase vehicles and the Camel Trophy. So I think it's just, you know, in terms of, you know, the adventure and off-trail challenge type stuff, I think the long wheelbase truck does it for me, and I love that orange color. I know it's some people either love it or hate it, but I like it. I like the G4 styling, even though the Camel Trophy was a much more badass competition.
Yeah, so someone changed the legislation in the next, several days?
And yes.
Do you think we can still get our order in?
Yeah, I think they've stopped taking orders.
Yeah, that's true. We could probably buy one on eBay for probably two or three times the markup, right?
Yeah, well, somebody's got to give me some money then.
So check out that article. If anything, at the bottom there are pictures of the one in that pale green that Harold just mentioned, and just interesting to see what they did with it and how it in some ways hasn't changed in 67 years. There's still some things that seem the same.
I like the throwback aspect of it. Really, of course, I would take any of those if they were given to me.
Oh, indeed. Of course we would, without question.
I would even take the autobiography, even though I think that makes the least sense of the three.
Yeah, right, right.
I'm trying to take a Defender and make it look like a Range Rover. It's like, why not just get a Range Rover?
So speaking of the heritage, Land Rover, and we mentioned this, I think, on the podcast last time, but I did some digging since. Land Rover UK has a site for Land Rover stories. Every Land Rover has a history. This is where we share the rich and entertaining stories which make your Landy special. So some interesting reading there. Or I think you can also submit your own, which a friend of the podcast, Graham and Louisa Bell, have done. But you can read about all different kinds of Rovers, not simply the series trucks. But I think there was an FC 101 I saw somewhere there.
I just saw a 2B FC.
2B, there we go. And
which is a 109, actually.
And
there's another one.
Another one. That's a Series 2A forward control.
2A or 2B, they're pretty much the same thing.
2A, there we go.
Is it 2A?
Yeah,
okay.
It says A there. So interesting. If you just want to read about them and you enjoy the learning about all different Land Rovers and what folks are doing with them, it was kind of a neat site. And if you have a story of your own that you wish to contribute, they are taking those there. The one thing I couldn't figure out how to do was search. So I wanted to look and track down some things, but I didn't see that.
I think they want you to read them all.
That's right, and go through them all. Moving on in the news, and this is not Land Rover specific, but since I had been to Gaydon last year, and went to the Heritage Motor Museum in Gaydon, they're closing tomorrow. We're recording the podcast here on the 29th of November. They're closing it starting tomorrow, the 30th of November, and they're going to reopen in February 13th, and they're going to rename themselves the British Motor Museum.
No, I think it's a good name. Heritage Motor Center didn't quite sound like a museum. It tended to sound like it was maybe a used car dealer of some, upscale sure. nature. But and I think that name derived from the fact that it was run by the British Motor Industry Heritage Trust, I think was the official name of the nonprofit behind the place, but the new name I think more accurately reflects the fact that it really is the official museum of the British motor industry.
Right. Plus, I think removing the word heritage, you could have some more modern vehicles too. So you think of heritage, you're thinking usually much older vehicles.
Well, and I think that's still going to be the thrust. But I think the heritage was nice in the sense that it really sort of underscored the idea that that's the depository of all of the heritage information, and because all of these companies, including the ones that have gone defunct, have passed their archives over to the trust, and so if you ever need to do research, in fact, anyone can do research on their British vehicle at the Heritage Motor Center.
Nice. If you check out their website, which of course we'll have a link to it, they mention here the new name reflects the designated status of the museum's collections and is the first step in a multi-million-pound redevelopment to showcase the world's largest collection of historic British cars. So kind of supports your point there, Harold. So
I think what they're trying to do is maybe expand the visual aspect and the museum aspect of the trust, and because that is just part of their function, of course, because they do have the archives and they are a research facility in that sense. But this is sort of the public arm that you see is the museum, and quite a lot of their collection actually wasn't seen. And I think that part of the revamping here is they're doing some changes to their exhibit to make more of that visible.
Hmm. Oh, adding some floor space or something to... I mean, things were...
I think they are actually adding facility.
Oh, okay. Oh, that'd be nice.
But I think they're also trying to rotate their collection a little more aggressively.
Gotcha. Yeah, things were pretty tight in there, too. They were a lot of cars crammed together.
I think I read somewhere about a new building being constructed.
Oh, nice. I didn't see it on their website, but I think the message that I saw about this looked like the building looked different than I remember it. So maybe that supports your point that they may have adding on. Maybe they're changing some of the facade and maybe an additional building. So they had land there. I didn't know that.
Well, they are adjacent to an old RAF base.
RAF Gaydon.
Right.
Yeah, very cool. And speaking of...
Which is Jaguar owned now, isn't it? Don't they own that facility? Doesn't somebody own that? I don't think it's RAF anymore, is it?
Oh, I don't think it's an air base anymore.
Yeah, I think that land is owned by JLR now.
Well, that's true. There is an experience there. You can do the Land Rover experience at the what is now the British Motor Museum. So maybe they do own part of that, or they share it maybe with the...
I thought I read that somewhere, but
You can do an experience there. They have a version of the Land Rover experience at the Motor Museum.
Right, at the Motor Museum, but I thought I read that a good chunk of RAF Gaydon was corporate-owned now.
Okay. Last month, we talked about the Guy Fawkes celebration, and there's a Land Rover event here in North America, in New York, and nicely, there was an article put Dave Bobeck did, and it's on Atlantic British, and we'll have a link to it in our show notes, of course, talking about the Guy Fawkes celebration, and he took a Range Rover supercharged to it, and kind of seemed to enjoy that, and talked about the event. There's a couple pictures, discussed some of the trails and things going on in the event, so in the bonfire. So if you're interested in a little more detail, because we didn't have much more detail the last time we talked about this event, we now have some more info about it.
Yeah, his article definitely covers it much better than we did.
That's true. He was there.
He was there. He should know, right?
Exactly. He was there. Apparently he had a problem with one of the tires when he was trying to leave, and had to swap out the valve stem off, and had to swap out to the spare tire. That's the picture we're looking at right now. But the bottom is where in Land Rover specific, something fun here. But he's another late departure because of the spare tire, and another effortless drive. Anyone that has not experienced a late model supercharged Land Rover should really give it a go.
I could not agree more.
Yes. I've heard
they are the high point of my job.
Yes. I have not enjoyed that experience.
Well, I'm sure if you had the experience, you would not enjoy it.
Yes. Well, I have... turbocharged Jetta. I've been in a turbocharged Series 3 ambulance, right?
No.
Yours is not turbocharged?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay, it will be. So maybe I haven't been in a turbocharged or supercharged Land Rovers. I don't think I have.
Turbos are nice, but the big difference between a turbocharged engine and a supercharged engine is the turbocharger, you don't really have anything when you first step on the gas, because it takes a while for the turbocharger to build up, and then all of a sudden it comes on, and then you get this big push behind you, whereas a supercharger, it's now.
It's now. It's always there, always available.
Yeah, I mean, you don't get as much on the top end, but you have instant satisfaction.
And isn't something you always want in when you put the foot down?
Supercharger makes everything better.
Nice. Well, that's the news, and we'll move on in the podcast.
Much is written about the American dream. Opportunities abound for anyone with a good idea and the willingness to work hard to achieve their goals. So it was in 1909 for George Pepperdine. Fresh out of business school, Pepperdine was earning a modest $15 a month keeping the books for the Southside Garage in Kansas City. He was looking for a better ways to provide for his family, and he saw an opportunity in America's growing love affair with the automobile. At the turn of the century, cars were nothing more than toys for the extra wealthy. But thanks to the efforts of people like Ransom Olds and Henry Ford, the car would soon be affordable to people of more modest means. However, they still weren't very reliable, and they required a constant supply of tires, oil, and other parts to keep them going. Lots of little garage businesses sprang up to provide these supplies and to perform the necessary maintenance and repairs. As the bookkeeper at one of these garages, Pepperdine was familiar with the manufacturers and the wholesale distributors that supplied his garage, and he was aware of how much profit was being made. He had a little idea that turned out to be a big thing. Instead of paying the big markups to a garage for all their automotive needs, what if there was a store where people could go and they could buy many of these things for less? If such a store could sell enough volume, even with a small markup, a tidy profit could be made. Unfortunately, George Pepperdine didn't have any money to buy inventory or rent a storefront, and it seemed like the dream was out of reach. But then he had another idea. If he could get the people to order parts by mail and pay in advance, he could use that money to buy from a wholesaler, ship to his customer, and pocket the difference. He eventually managed to find a printer willing to run off 500 copies of a sales flyer on credit, and he scraped together $5 for postage. George Pepperdine was now chasing the American dream. That first flyer was a single-page list with just a few of the most common items. He called his new enterprise the Western Auto Supply Agency. With help from Mrs. Pepperdine, they affixed the one-cent postage stamp and addressed each flyer by hand on their kitchen table. Several days later, the first order came in, earning him 20 cents. By the end of the month, he had made $100, which is far more than he made at his bookkeeping job. It didn't take long for George to quit that job and devote all his time to his new business venture. He rented a desk and a display window at a local car dealership where he could display a few of his items for sale. While Western Auto aimed to supply parts for all cars, the biggest market was Ford's Model T. It was America's most popular car, probably because it was the cheapest. One of the reasons it was cheap was because it was completely devoid of frills, a bare-bones vehicle that was sometimes little more than four wheels and an engine. Pepperdine saw tremendous potential in offering accessories to complete the Model T, like bumpers, fenders, windshields, tops, and even headlights and taillights. Western Auto's sales flyer grew with a steadily increasing list of parts and accessories. By 1912, it was a 36-page catalog, and the company had gross sales of $67,000. The following year, Pepperdine achieved his dream of opening a Western Auto retail store when he rented a storefront on Grand Avenue in Kansas City. In addition to the display area, there was also enough space for the bookkeeping and mail order operations. Sales reached $100,000, but profits were still slim due to the increased overhead. In 1914, over 100,000 catalogs were mailed, and the company finally earned a decent profit, more than in its first 5 years combined. Sadly, this was also the year that George Pepperdine developed health problems that would change the direction of the company. He was diagnosed with tuberculosis, and his doctor recommended he spend time in Denver to recuperate in the dry air. Since he was going to be stuck there for quite some time with nothing else to do, Pepperdine figured he may as well open a Western Auto store in Denver. After a year, his health hadn't improved, so he decided to go as far west as possible and permanently relocated his family to Los Angeles. Fearing that he couldn't run the Kansas City operation from Los Angeles, Pepperdine hatched a very curious plan. He split the company in two, keeping the Denver store for himself and selling the Kansas City store to Don Davis, a printing salesman who had been publishing Western Auto's catalog since 1910. The plan was that Pepperdine would market to all customers in the Rocky Mountain and Western states, and Davis would have the rest of the country. Oddly enough, both companies kept the Western Auto Supply Agency name. Davis continued to publish the catalogs for both companies, and other than the address on the cover and a few of the names inside, they were identical. The products in the two catalogs would gradually differ, but for many years it was difficult to tell that they were two different companies. Business was good, and by the end of the 1920s, both companies were multi-million-dollar corporations. Pepperdine and Davis negotiated a merger of the two companies, but the stock market crash of 1929 killed the deal and plunged the nation into the Great Depression. Pepperdine had to scale back and close many of his smaller stores. The company survived, but Pepperdine's spirit was broken. In the late 1930s, he sold his company, and he focused his energy on his new dream, philanthropy. As a devout Christian, he felt it was wrong to amass a great personal fortune and not use it to help other people. He decided that the most efficient way to help the largest number of people was with education, and in 1937, he founded a college bearing his name in Los Angeles. By the early 1970s, Pepperdine University had moved to a new campus in nearby Malibu. Many describe it as America's most beautiful college campus. Meanwhile, in Kansas City, Don Davis's Western Auto Supply Company was virtually unaffected by the Great Depression, continuing to expand and never failing to pay dividends to its shareholders. Davis had grown his company more carefully than Pepperdine, limiting his stores to larger cities and relying on catalog sales to reach customers in the small towns. Product lines grew and diversified into many non-automotive items like camping gear, sporting goods, bicycles, and radios. In 1935, the company was healthy and ready to expand in a big way. Many states had laws designed to protect local merchants from the unfair competition of large national chains. but the company had a plan to get around this. It was called the Western Auto Associates Store. It was a simple agreement that allowed local merchants to purchase inventory at wholesale and to use the Western Auto name on their stores. It was a real win-win. The small-town store got a nationally recognized brand and access to thousands of product lines supported by national advertising. The company got outlets for its products in small towns all over the country. The Associate Store program was not a conventional franchise agreement, as there was no license fee and no recurring royalties. The associate just had to promise to buy a certain percent of its inventory from the company. There were no restrictions on minimum quantities. It was up to the individual store owners to decide which products to carry, based on their particular interest and the needs of their community. Some chose to sell only auto parts, and some just hardware and tools. Other associates chose to be a general store by carrying a little bit of everything the company offered. At its peak in the 1960s, there were over 5,000 Western Auto stores. Homes in small-town America were filled with Wizard appliances, True Tone radios and TVs, and countless other products from the local Western Auto Associates store. People who grew up in this time will probably remember the Western Flyer bikes and all the toys at Christmas. Good quality merchandise at reasonable prices made life better. But more than that, the Associate Store program made the American dream possible for thousands of small-town families. And so it was for my grandparents. Their dream was to live and retire in the quaint little town of Ligonier in western Pennsylvania. In the late 1950s, an Associate Store helped to make that dream possible. It was a nice little store with a nice selection of products. My grandmother loved to sew, so she put a sewing machine in the front of the store, where she could sit and sew while watching for customers. When someone came in, she was right there to help them find what they needed. After they left, she was right back to her sewing. Occasionally, she would even sell a sewing machine, and perhaps a lesson or two. She was also quite proud that she knew all the car parts. She didn't always know what they did, but she knew what they were. My grandparents didn't have their store very long, but it made them a good living for several years. They were able to retire and live out their lives in Ligonier. It was their dream. Times have changed, and the Western Auto Supply Company is gone. It was once known as a national institution, but all that remains now are memories. I still have a few of my grandparents' Wizard tools, and I use them when I have the chance. It allows me to stay connected with my grandparents and also with the company that helped make their dreams happen.
Welcome back to the 32nd edition of the Center Steer podcast. Now joining us via Skype is Ben Gribben from funrover.com. He's been on the show before. Welcome back, Ben.
Hello. Hi.
And where are you located in the UK? You're up near Birmingham, right?
No. Ooh, no, don't say that. up north where they filmed Last of the Summer Wine, if you've heard of that.
Yes, I have.
I think it's the world's longest running sitcom, or it was at one point.
Yeah.
Until, like, The Simpsons or something overtook it. Yeah.
I think so. I've seen a couple episodes of the Last of the Summer Wine. That's those older gentlemen who were in the last of their years and having a good time, right? Yeah. And so Ben is with funrover.com, and that's how we found out about you. You've over the years have a website talking about Fun Rover things. That's hence it's in the title. And currently you're working on a Defender Tribute rebuild. Is that correct?
It's correct, yes.
Tell our listeners you're on episode 12. They've been up on YouTube about every 2 weeks or so. So why don't you tell our listeners where things stand, how it got started? I guess that's the first question. How'd you get started? With the rebuild, of course.
With the rebuild, I wanted to just freshen up the Land Rover. So I think it was 2 years ago I actually pulled it all apart, and it sat there for, well, about a year and a half in my workshop, kind of just gathering dust and beginning to corrode very slightly. And then...
Only slightly?
A lot. It's quite a damp workshop. And then I thought, well, I need to put this back together. My wife and I were hoping to move to Ireland, like at the start of next year. So if I don't get this Land Rover done, it's just going to sit there forever. So I thought, right, now or never, let's do it. And obviously it's coming up to the time when I think they've extended the production of the Defender to April now. But I thought, well, I'm going to time it where I've finished it at the same time as some of the last Defenders are rolling off the production line. I was a bit disappointed with the Heritage Edition special edition Land Rovers. I thought, yeah, it looks all right, but it's a bit boring. If you've bought one, they're fantastic.
Of course.
But I keep saying I want to make the ultimate Land Rover tribute. Really, it's just my own interpretation of that.
Well, that's what everybody defines as ultimate. Yeah.
So what specific is it? It's a D90, right? What year?
It's a 1999 Land Rover TD5. So it's a 90-inch wheelbase with a diesel engine that is kind of gaining more popularity over here now because the 300 TDIs, 200s, becoming harder to find, and people are starting to realize, oh, well, electronics aren't, you know, the devil's work.
Yes.
Well, maybe on a TDCI.
Speak for yourself.
So,
well, you know, we bring the 200 TDIs over to America because we need them here.
Yeah, I like that's a proper Land Rover engine, but I also like the TD5 because there's a lot of opportunity there to tune it, improve the performance and efficiency of it. So it's quite a modern engine in Land Rover terms.
So they did a good job with that engine. All joking aside about the electronics, it is a good engine.
Mm.
So what is the scope of your rebuild and your tribute? So you said it's your interpretation, obviously, but can you give us highlights? What's the highlights of your tribute?
Okay, so my whole kind of mantra for the build is I want it to look as though it could have rolled off the Land Rover production line and be as well like future proof. So kind of combining that, I've gone for a galvanized chassis or frame, I think you call it in America.
Yes.
That was like a brand new replacement part from a company that's not too far from where my workshop is. So that's hopefully going to, you know, make it last 25, 30 years, depending on how salty the Irish air is. Then I'm galvanizing as many components as I can. So the bulkhead is about to go off to the galvanizers. I'm going to make a jig up so that it shouldn't distort due to the extreme heat that it's applied underneath. Everything that I could, I've taken to a shot blaster or a bead blaster, mm-hmm. and they've removed corrosion, old paint, so I'm back to bare metal. I'm going to hit those with epoxy sealers, I think they call them in America, like just a rust inhibiting primer.
Right.
And then work from there, give it a kind of factory finish coating, so usually like satin black for most components. I've rebuilt all the axles, pretty much all new components apart from the diffs, which I just swapped from the front to the rear, mm-hmm. so that I've kind of evened the wear out. It had done 75,000 miles when I pulled it apart and was about 15 years old, so it was showing a little bit of kind of its age. So
that's still brand new for us.
Yeah, it's not an export worthy one yet.
It is export worthy. It's just not old enough.
Yeah, well, yeah, a couple more years. I'm taking the roof off and we're going for a canvas hood.
Nice.
Which is maybe not the best of idea in a country where it rains pretty much all year, but
unless you like getting wet.
Well, it'll get you acclimatized to the to the weather outside. You know, you've got that nice kind of acclimatization period.
As long as you don't use the bikini top version, just if you're doing a full, you know, the full canvas top, you should be fine. Should be.
I'm going to get rid of, at the minute, most Defenders over here have solid windscreen brackets. So if you did have a canvas top and you took your sticks out, you took your rag top off, you've still got the windscreen stuck up. So I'm going to go to the old-fashioned hinges where you can drop it down.
Series 3?
Nice.
Yeah. Yep. Well, no, these are actually, I think they're a military part. I managed to bag the last two in stock.
They make them for the Defender. I thought you had to put Series 3 hinges on to do it.
I think it's a Defender part number.
Okay,
so
cool.
I don't know. It's hopefully going to fit. That's what I'm majorly concerned about. And then...
So the spare will not be on the bonnet then?
The spare is going to be on the bonnet. I'm working on reinforcing the TD5 bonnet. You could do it on a 300 that had a stronger bonnet. So I'm going to try.
But I have to. I have to ask if you're gonna put the spare on the bonnet and then you want to take then you want to put the windscreen down.
Yeah,
that doesn't seem.
There's room.
There is room. You can do that.
You could do it on yours if you want.
Yeah. Wouldn't it just stick up? It's going to hit the. It's going to hit the tire.
Yeah, but the hinge is above the height of the tire.
I guess I never really noticed.
Go take a look at your 109.
Okay.
Because you got this section where the vent scuttles are.
Where the scuttles are. Okay, that would raise it up theoretically above. And then there's a dimple in the bonnet for the tire.
Well, not on his bonnet. That's the problem.
There is a divot.
Is there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just going to try it and see. If it doesn't work, I've still got my old brackets.
Well, that's where you carry the extra spare that's skinny.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
You should do. If it's going on your bonnet and your bonnet stay failed ever, you want the thinnest wheel on the bonnet possible, I guess.
Yeah, it's more for show than for go.
Yeah.
But in my interpretation of the Ultimate Land Rover, it's got to be on the bonnet. That's the only place, I think.
We completely agree.
That is the iconic look.
Yeah, it's just, and also a great place to put your beer cans and stuff when you want a trash can.
Absolutely.
And then finally, I'm going the opposite to most people, taking all the soundproofing out and putting old-fashioned seats in from a Series 2, Series 3. And I'm also reproducing a sort of Series 2A style dash. So it's essentially attached to the bulkhead, part of the bulkhead.
Metal dash.
Yeah. So I'm having a fabricator kind of make me one of those to experiment, see if we can do that, and put the dials in the middle, and yeah, hopefully it should be.
You're going to use the Series 2 style dials then? And
I'm not sure whether I can or not, but if I can, I can replace the graphics on the Defender instrument with like vinyl graphics that I can design. So
yeah,
it's going to be a lot of work. I'm getting rid of all the dash bulbs for kind of old fashioned, you know, like chrome bezeled panel bulbs with the little label underneath and rocker switches. But it's going to be as though Land Rover carried on developing the series line of vehicles. Well, that's what I'm trying to do anyway. So.
And perhaps stopped improving them.
Yeah, well, that's it. A lot of the build quality, it's never been.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah, it's never been great, but some of the newer Defenders, they're just interesting.
Yeah. So you're saying the newer Defenders are too nice and you have to make these mods to make it more correct?
I had a 2008 Defender, and there's a lot of comfort upgrades, but the build quality itself, the materials used, the chassis rust so quickly. Mm. It was only, 6 years old when I had it, and yeah, it was already beginning to rust, so...
Hmm.
I think with mine, I've learned from all the Land Rovers that I've had, and I'm trying to combine into one vehicle every upgrade, every possible modification I can make to hopefully prevent me having to do any major work for hopefully five years.
So how much time a week are you spending? Is this your full-time gig at this point?
No, I'm very fortunate. I work over the internet for a company in Australia, who basically I work very flexible hours, so I can get over to the workshop sort of noon until 6-7 o'clock at night, and then that means I can put in serious time with my work and then actually put in some really decent time at the workshop as well. So
are you doing this all by yourself?
I've got help from some of the other chaps down some of the other chaps down there that have a workshop all into Land Rovers. They've raced Series 1 mid-engined builds they've created themselves, and it's a great place if you've got a Land Rover, because you can kind of say, oh, how on earth do I do this? And they'll just come over and help you, and it's a great little thing. So I've made friends with a few of the people down there, and they come and help out. You might have seen them in some of the videos. So, but yeah, most of the time it's just me plugging away and trying not to get too kind of down with it, because it's such an overwhelming thing sometimes if you really stop and think about it. It's a lot of work.
Really?
Says the man who does it every day. Yeah. Well, you do a nice job on the videos, by the way. I think it clearly you're spending some time doing the work, but you're also spending time with the video production, and that's turning out well. So I give a little compliment to that.
It's kind of easy to do one or the other, but to do both is an extra challenge.
It does take longer, admittedly. It can be a bit frustrating when you could just get on with something, but if you've not done it before, you want to practice first before you do it on the video, and you've got to set your video up and change angles regularly. And so I'm shooting it all by myself as well, usually. So it adds a whole another level to it, but I'm receiving mostly positive comments from the online community. You do get a lot of people, oh, why are you doing this? Kind of rivet counters or bolt counters. But do you know what? It's my Land Rover, so at the end of the day, I'm happy with it. And if that's what happens, then so be it. So, yeah.
Everybody's got an opinion.
And they like to share them on the internet.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. And instead, they could come over and help you out with the spanners and. And
that would be always accepted.
See, yep. There you go. So if you're
except the people who share their opinions so freely usually don't know how to run the tools. They just like to sound like they do.
Mm.
So
armchair mechanics, they're called sometimes.
Yeah.
Yep. We have those. Or we like to call them Monday morning quarterbacks too. That's the term we have here. Now that they do football all the time though, that doesn't apply as much.
Yeah.
So you're spending like what, 6 days a week, 5 days a week on this? You're putting a lot of time in.
Ideally seven, yeah.
You think you're making good progress? Is this coming along at the pace you're expecting?
No.
I'll take that as it's going slower than you thought.
On the other hand, you only have to keep pace with Land Rovers. If they stretch out the production, you're still okay.
Well, that's it, yeah. I was kind of a bit glad when they said, oh, originally it was January, then they moved it to April. Oh, phew. I've got a couple more months.
Except the 2 millionth is going to be auctioned off in 2 weeks, so you better...
I'll just ignore that. Because they're going to go beyond that anyway, aren't they? They'll be the 2 millionth and 100 and whatever.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to aim for the 1st of January. But it's now, what, 2nd, 3rd of December?
It's the 2nd, yeah.
So we'll see. I've still got all the painting to do, all the preparation. The rear tub has quite a few replacement panels that I need to cut in and rivet in place. And, yeah, we'll see how it goes.
What's the ultimate end state? Like, it's going to be painted. What color? Are you using the same wheels? Because I saw you got new wheels and you repainted those. That was at least the last episode. I think the last episode.
It was the last episode, which was in real time about a week ago. I've not had much time this week, unfortunately. the end color, I bought pastel green.
Ooh.
I think I bought that maybe over a year and a half ago, and it sat in the workshop. So we'll see what it's like when I open the tin.
It's getting greener all the time.
It may be congealed into a big block of green.
I think that was the original color, was a big congealed block of green.
That's what it says on the tin. hopefully it should be okay. I've had to go for a non-isocyanate containing paint because I'm doing this in a DIY environment. So if I was to use professional grade paints, I could end up poisoning myself unless I purchased expensive gear to prevent that. So we'll see how that goes. I've heard it's not very good in cold weather, and I've managed to land at almost the coldest part of the year when I'm painting. So,
good planning. Yeah,
there's no planning. It's just... We'll get and see. So.
Will the metal dash be the same color as the outside? Is that the plan?
Yeah, it will be.
Well, I at least in my head, it looks
how
good.
It was always done in the past.
Yeah, right. I was wondering if he maybe was going to go with a Paul Smith edition with everything being a different color.
No, it looks like it was made out of Lego or something. It was such a bad. No.
I know. But, yeah.
I'm just thinking that, you know, we do this all the time just to keep our rovers going, and this. Idiot gets paid $100,000 to put one together. I mean, come on.
I think I paid more than that.
Well, whatever. I'm, figure of speech.
Yeah.
it was just paintwork and a different interior as well, which was kind of a bit depressing, really.
Yeah. When you could just let it happen naturally, and, right. and it'll naturally yeah. become a different color if you let it sit.
Yeah.
Just swap some panels around.
Yeah, I like the patina look. Yeah. What's the canvas roof going to be? Is that going to be kind of a light colored canvas, or are you going to have a back window? Having familiarity with my canvas and my 109, I'm kind of curious what.
There's one specific truck that I found. It's a Series 2A. That it's actually in America. Somebody's put a Mercedes engine into it, and it's got pastel green bodywork with a sand canvas roof. And I think that's what I'm going to go for. I'm sort of trying to order one now, and I'm ringing all these canvas companies up, and nobody wants to take my money. So it's particularly frustrating.
Really?
A couple of companies I've rung, they've got 10-week lead times, which takes me way past January the 1st.
Right.
So I actually said to one company the other day, I will pay you more money if you can do it by this date. So, sand canvas with windows in the side because we've got a dog and it likes to have a little gaze out, and one at the back as well. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully I'll be able to order one soonish.
Have you checked EMLRA, the ex-Military Land Rover Association? They might have some leads on some canvas for you. That might be something for you. It's emlra.org. I'm actually a member. So after this, if you want to, I can do some checking, I think, on some things for you. They have a Tatton, was it Tatton Barrow? Is that how you say it?
I don't know.
That's like leftover. Does that mean leftovers? We don't use that phrase here in America.
Like surplus.
Surplus, yeah. And so they might have something for you, or at least maybe even temporary. Maybe able to find something not in the best condition, but might be used.
Mm, last thing, I can't run the vehicle without a roof, can I?
Really?
I've committed to it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not the time of year. I'm not Californian.
So what sort of mechanical changes are you making? Are you making any mechanical changes, like the transmission staying the same? Or
basically just ironing out problems that I've found as I pull it apart, and also common faults with the TD5 and Defenders in general. So as I pulled it apart, the ECU was full of oil, which is a common thing with those. The oil wicks up the injector seals and then kind of like works its way along the loom over a couple of years into your ECU.
Welcome to the only part on a Land Rover where oil leaks in.
I'm sure a salesman would tell you that's a corrosion busting feature or something.
But there you go.
I don't think it's ruined it, because it was full of oil when I pulled it apart and it was still working. So I'm going to have to replace the injectors. Also, just stuff like the manifold studs, two of those had snapped because they have a common problem where the extreme exhaust gas temperatures cause the manifold to bend and warp, and then that snaps two of the studs, and mine managed to snap inside the cylinder head, not protruding in any way, so that was a little bit annoying. But
sucks to be you.
Yeah. Well, you'd think they'd design something that's meant to deal with hot temperatures, to withstand hot temperatures, but that would be too much of common sense, I guess. So, yeah, it's just stuff like that. I'm not going to change the transfer box. I was thinking about it, going for a Discovery transfer box, which has a lower ratio, which I think gives you kind of slightly less revs at a higher speed. But
at the expense of being able to take off in first gear.
Yeah, that's the, like when you're towing as well, you're going to really notice that.
Right, sure. You have the 1.4 in there now?
Yeah.
Are you going to be towing?
Probably not, but in my mind, I like to think that I tow a lot.
you want the option.
Yeah.
Anytime I get to tow a broken car, someone's stuck in snow, I jump on the chance. And I might even be able to get a trailer in Ireland. I don't know. The other thing I was thinking about, they only have 7 or 8 kind of major motorways or interstates. So really, I'm not going to be doing a lot of top speed, high speed driving anyway. So,
well, you said you're moving to an island. Take it. Ireland, was that what I...
To the island, yeah.
The island, is that what you guys call it? The island? Ireland, is it the island?
Well, no, it's just called Ireland, the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah. Oh, Ireland. Yeah, I'm hearing Island. I'm hearing Island. Sorry. My accent translator was not working. So you're moving to the Republic of Ireland. Oh, that's nice. Is your wife Irish, I take it? Or is he just, let's go somewhere?
Just something we both fancy doing always wanted to do and just thought, why not?
good idea. So, okay, so you're going to be, so you'd be in Ireland and then you might need to move and take some of your stuff with you and potentially, tow. So you were talking about the ratio.
Yeah, you might be able to get what you need with an overdrive.
I'd like an overdrive, but at the minute the cost of one is prohibitive, I think.
Yeah, they're not cheap. They're a nice way to go, but they're not cheap.
They are, because someone was saying, is it the Rover Drive will also work in low box? That would be really cool.
Rover Drive makes a version for the LT230 as well as one for the Series.
Okay.
And it is a nice unit.
Do they do one for the R380?
Well, the thing is, the R380 that doesn't affect the overdrive, because the overdrive actually is by the transfer case.
See what you say. Okay. Well, I could look at it. The thing I'm trying to remember is, if I can't do it now, I can always do stuff in the future, because Land Rovers are of that nature, out of the way. If you need to kind of pull the floor out to fit something, it's pretty easy to do. So, especially once you've got new parts and everything's been greased up, so you're not struggling with rusted bits.
Right. Yes. And hopefully you don't take the transmission in and out 5 times in, 3-4 years?
Something like that.
Yes, somebody's had to do it. Yeah.
Some unnamed person.
Some unnamed individual who I'm looking at. Yeah. So you have had some help, but I think do you have actual sponsorship for this? Is that to get this done? I mean, you're not, this is not all coming out of your pocket, I take it.
I'm working with a number of companies. I'm quite fortunate to have a big Land Rover, an experienced Land Rover parts supplier who help out with the videos. I'm not receiving everything for free, contrary to popular opinion, which would be very nice.
Of course.
Yeah, but obviously there's a lot of work involved in the videos and editing that and then promoting it. So I get some reasonable incentives. And then kind of frost.co.uk, they're a really cool company. They do a lot of Eastwood products, the paint company over in America.
If I ever need any.
Yeah, really good products. I enjoy using those. So if I ever need anything from them, we kind of sort something out and just take it from there.
So how much do you anticipate this is going to cost you? Don't take into it like free stuff, but I mean, if you were paying it all out of your pocket, do you have a sense of it? Is this like a 40,000 pound rebuild?
I did wonder whether I should not work it out. I know that sounds bad.
Sometimes you don't want to know.
Yes.
Or at least you don't want your wife to know.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to let her listen to this. So, I did start adding things up the other day, and sort of within the first month, we were looking at £7,000 had gone. So that would be, I don't know, at the minute, $15,000 or
roughly double,
40,000. Yeah,
so I think it's a bit less, but even that seems a bit cheap than from what I'm hearing so far. I mean,
he's not adding for the labor.
True, labor's not included, right?
Oh, and that's only just sort of the chassis and some of my first orders that I made in the first month. So since then, I don't know, over $20,000 easily when it's finished. But then hopefully I'll have the thing with Land Rovers is, if you put that money into them, you shouldn't lose it too much. I know you will with like kind of fancy stuff like winches and stuff like that, because they're add-on bits. But with the base vehicle, hopefully I shouldn't lose too much. Almost an investment. That's how I've been selling it to the wife anyway.
Well, in another 10 years, you can export it to the States and then double your money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll have to think about that.
That's right. And you can say you did a complete rebuild. It's all documented.
Yep.
And you have it on video. You have the receipts. So you have the provenance, and we'll know who you are. There you go. You can make your money back. What about tools? Like, do you have all the tools, or are you lucky enough to get help in that area? Because usually what I find, me not being the handy person as I am, but I do find the right tool does help.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good motto to work by is have the right tool for the right job.
Mm-hmm.
When I started, I had maybe just a bit more than a basic complement of tools, and over the build, you come across problems and things, and you just think, I'm going to buy the tool for this because it'll come in handy. So, yeah, I've got quite a bit of toolage. Is that a word? I don't know.
It is now.
But it's all stuff you can reuse in the future. That's the brilliant thing about tools. And I'm just sort of collecting stuff, and I've just surprisingly just got my first soft face hammer today.
Ooh, really?
Which says a lot, because up until now, my soft face hammer was hitting things slightly less hard than with a lump hammer.
Now, so you're supposed to put your hand over the end of the hammer.
Oh, yeah, that's a good idea.
Is that what that means?
Yes.
So just slowly collecting stuff. What have I bought this last few weeks? A hammer and dolly set for bodyworking, which I'm excited about. I've just bought an electronic wire wheel so I can start cleaning old nuts and bolts up if I really need to reuse them. So, I'm kind of gathering this small engineering setup, which is cool. So if I ever need to do anything else, I'm prepared to do it then, which is nice.
Well, you're going to definitely need that diesel with the low range to carry all that heavy tools with you to Ireland.
Absolutely. It's going to be a large lorry, I think.
Yes. Well, that's the nice thing about Land Rovers, too, is typically the tools that you would normally commonly use, you can use them on the Land Rover. You don't need many, especially on the older models, specialized tools.
Mm.
It's not you don't need that special oil change, wrench that some of these vehicles have, and weird things to get out, weird tools. Come on, help me out here, Harold. He's looking at me.
No, you're digging your own hole just fine.
Gee, thanks. You can help me out with the, yes, you need that specialized tool.
There are a few special tools you need, but not that many, all things considered.
But I'm thinking about more modern cars, usually need some, there's always a specialized tool you're going to need somewhere.
Well, you
start sometimes.
A code reader, an engine code reader with a new car. So,
are you able, do you have auto parts stores in the UK that will let you use their code reader? Because we have a couple here that will do that. They'll lend you a code reader.
If I went and talked to a local garage, I'm sure they probably would. But you can buy OBD port readers quite reasonably priced. I've got a smart gauge, which is primarily a fuel and engine readout dial.
Right.
That also has a very basic kind of code reader in there, so that's quite useful.
Yeah, very basic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it gives you an idea if it's something catastrophic, then you know what you're dealing with.
It just tells you have to go into the dealership where they then charge you exorbitant prices to read the specific code to tell you what the sensor really says.
Yeah.
So what part of this do you enjoy the most? Do you like the do you like the mechanical side? Do you like the bodywork side, or the demolition, the rebuild?
I think bolting new components on is also always fun. And I used to like getting the parcels of new products and things and ripping it open, but
that's like Christmas morning.
Yeah, but after a while, you just get fed up of it, and the package becomes this barrier to what you're actually trying to achieve. So for me, probably the bodywork, I'd say, but also right now is just getting it done would be the most satisfying thing. If I can put it back together, it all still works, and I don't make a fool of myself on the internet.
I don't think that's definitely true. What's the future coming? Like, where are you now? What have you done? Let's give us a little update. And then where are you going to? What's happening in the next couple of weeks? I realize you don't know the exact end date, but like, what's going to happen in the next 2-3 weeks, month?
Okay. Well, at the weekend, I'll be starting the tub repair. I'm hopefully going to take delivery of is it LumiWeld? I think it's an American product. It's supposedly Bermabrite compatible brazing rods. So you can use a torch and repair holes and things that you might have in Bermabrite bodywork.
Good luck with that.
So, yeah, well, it's a
be
kind of
very
an
very careful.
See how that goes. I've got so many holes in the tub that previous owners have drilled in and what have you. I don't want to replace the tub because I've replaced that many components. I'm starting to not really have the same car anymore. Mm-hmm. So I'll be on with the tub repair. I've got a whole host of stuff to take to the galvanizers, which is quite a way away, and I don't actually have a trailer at the minute, so that'll be interesting. I'm kind of abusing a Jaguar X-Type, call it the Jag van, for taking everything around. And then I can actually start on painting in the next couple of weeks. At the same time, I'll be putting the engine and gearbox back in and sorting all the wiring out and also the fuel and brake lines. And then, I don't know, I could be approaching first startup in 3-4 weeks, maybe.
That's sounds great.
Cool.
Yes, if not ambitious, but certainly sounds great.
Yeah, well,
it's good to have ambitions.
Aim for January the 1st. Then I think it'll probably get done quicker, even if I don't necessarily meet that date. So
right. Now, on the tub, just so for my clarification, so Bermabrite is what we would basically say is aluminum. So is this aluminum repair?
It is aluminum. Bermabrite was a trademarked alloy of aluminum.
Okay. So and it's so you're gonna be filling the holes. So that's basically aluminum repair. So and that's a highly specialized skill, I take it.
It's tricky with a torch. They make these products that allow you to do it, but the problem with using a torch is that, you know, you're warming up the aluminum to where the filler rod can melt and flow in, and then all of a sudden your whole panel is gone.
Ah.
Yeah. I'm told LumiWeld has a very low melting point, so hopefully this should get around it. The other option I had is find a TIG welder who was willing to do it, but because it is an alloy of, I think the quantities are known, but you would have to get filler rods made up, and it's just fairly difficult to do. So I've not been able to find anyone willing to take on TIG welding the tub as such yet.
So we look forward to that video because that sounds like that'll be a good one to see.
Got any scraps you can practice on?
Well, yeah, I've got a couple of the old, like the grill slam. I'm not going to use that. I think it's aluminium. I'm going to have to test first to make sure it is. But yeah, I'll kind of practice it. And then if it all goes completely wrong, I might just have to put checker plate over the tub, which I didn't want to do because I'm not a huge fan of checker plate, unless it's sort of on your wings for functional use.
Right.
So we'll have to see. We'll have to see about that.
Good, good. So when this is all done, January 1, we're going to hold you to that. how are you going to use it? Is this going to be a daily driver? Are you going to take it to shows? You go into, you're going to take it off-road, such as Green Laning is in the UK?
It will be my daily driver. When I pulled it apart, it was. And I replaced it with the TDCI I talked about. I've just recently got rid of that. So I'm actually, at the moment, bereft of a functioning Land Rover. So, I'm looking forward to getting that back and then just exploring the Republic of Ireland in it. And
thank you.
I don't think they have green lanes there. I don't think that is a thing.
I think everything there, by definition, is a green lane.
It's green lane, yeah.
I think if you ask the guy that owns the land, or the woman, or the family, then they'll just sort of, it's fine. Common sense rules.
You're not going to embark on a round the world trip in the tribute truck. Seems like everybody is.
I'd like to do, but that's kind of a bit very very dumb thing now, isn't it?
So, it is. It's certainly as ambitious.
I don't know.
You would definitely have to take the canvas top off, though. You're going to need a hard top for that one.
Yeah, for like security reasons and stuff. And also storage.
Yeah.
The roof racks for canvas roofs so much more money because obviously you've got a support structure in addition to the roof, and yeah, it's just complicated. So.
And they're ugly.
Yeah, well, yeah. That's the other thing. So, yeah, I hadn't really thought beyond a dead and think kind of past the end of it, because then all of a sudden, what will I film and what am I going to write about and stuff like that? So I'm not sure, really. Open to suggestions, though.
Well, come to America and just drive around the country and show it off. You can, and then you can use the canvas top. You can get away with that. We know people. They'll put you up for a couple of days, you know.
Yeah?
Yeah, oh, cool. Yeah, absolutely. You can come stay with us. Yeah, there's I got space here. Yeah.
Well, I'll get it shipped over there.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. It'll all work out. So would you do this again? I know you're only like two-thirds of the way in, maybe half the way in. Do you think you'd want to do this again?
I'm not sure.
Too soon to ask, huh?
Like I don't know how Harold does it for a job, because I just find it all consuming. Like whatever I'm doing, any spare time, I'm thinking, oh, I could do this with that, and I could be buying this, and it's just a bit much. And I think sometimes if you have this interest in a vehicle, a Land Rover, and then you kind of go further with it, like I have done, you kind of run the risk of maybe not enjoying them anymore, and it starts to feel like a chore, which it shouldn't do. But at the minute, it's okay, and I'm still enjoying it, but I'm just very aware that once you take something apart, you're committed to putting it back together, because you've just suddenly ruined the value of the vehicle. And but yeah, it is a very satisfying thing to do. And also when it's done, then you put your print on that vehicle. It is your Land Rover. So that's quite cool. So I don't know, maybe just a motorbike in a shed. That'd be nice.
any tips for anybody embarking upon this idea, or if they were thinking about it? Is there anything you would you've learned that you would like to look into?
In I think it was the second video, I talked about some of the stuff you should think about if you want to do a rebuild. Obviously, money is a big issue, so it can really hold you up if you haven't got either some savings sorted out, or if you're going to do a rolling restoration where you can keep it on the road and just do jobs over the weekend or something. Tools, not factoring in the cost of tools, because even if you've got a good range of equipment, you will need to buy more bits and bobs. Parts.
Never have enough.
You can never have enough. That's true. And you do end up doubling up on stuff like spanners and socket sets. It's always handy having, like, if you've got friends coming over to help and they don't have enough tools, well, then they're not particularly productive. Parts suppliers, get yourself a parts catalogue and a workshop manual for your Land Rover. That's a must. And I actually find the parts manual more useful quite a lot of the time, because I disassembled the car so long ago, you forget how things go together, which leads me into my next thing, actually. So you can look at the parts manual, see how everything goes together in like an exploded diagram. And then when you're pulling things apart, take as many photographs and notes and just like references as you can, because you might at the time think, oh, this is fine. But you've got about, I don't know, 10,000 different components and fixings and washers, and remembering where all those go in just your memory is not going to work at all. So
really?
Take photos, and yeah, I've learned that the hard way and managed to sweep up probably, you know, stuff that you can only buy as genuine products. So that's quite annoying sometimes.
I saw in your one video, and I apologize, I can't remember which one, but you did put the bolts back in. You made a comment about that. Was it on the doors, I think? And you took the bolts out and put the bolts back in and said, you know, so you don't lose them and you know where they go. I thought that was a good tip.
I can't remember. Yeah. I did actually lose two hubs. You know, the complete wheel bearing carrier. I lost two of those. I don't even know how that's possible.
And how do you lose a hub?
Well, yeah, how do you lose two?
It's with the other one.
And it was annoying, because when I looked to buy more, obviously it's only something you want to buy as a new component. So I bought two new replacement parts. And then about 2 months later, moved a load of boxes and I managed to find my old ones. So organization, which I don't really do organization, but you need some sort of system to make sure you don't waste money at the end of the day, which is a problem sometimes. I've got kind of triples of some bolts and things. You buy one and then you forget you've bought it or you lose it and end up having to buy more. So, yeah, be organized.
So that's the truck and the Defender Tribute rebuild. What's next for funrover.com?
I'm not really sure. I'm not sure. I don't know if I can really tell you this, but tomorrow, I was asked not to tell anyone, but you know what? It's fine. Tomorrow, I'm going to collect an award for Funrover from the Guild of Motoring Writers.
Oh, nice. Congratulations.
It's kind of like a big organization of motoring journalists who recognize bloggers as well, which is quite cool. So I've got to go down to London, collect that, which is fine, I guess. But it also, as part of the prize, you get kind of industrial experience with motor journalism. So I don't know. We'll see. It'd be interesting to – I've thought about maybe write a book about the build and what have you, because people on forums and stuff have been saying, well – you know, I like the detail that the forum threads can go to. You can't necessarily do it in a video as much.
Right.
So maybe a book, but then again, it'd be just like a great big parts manual or workshop manual. So and just more back to more blog posts and one-off videos about sort of like how to go green lane and stuff like that. So
nice.
That's the plan. But we'll have to see what comes up.
Well, congratulations on the award. That's good to hear. And this will be out after you get your award. So
yeah, so should be okay.
Yeah, exactly. So, you'll be fine.
A couple of days ago, I went to pick up an award.
There we go.
And
you had
a really good event.
You had a great experience. The dinner was wonderful. It tasted well. You dressed well.
Yeah,
you had no problems getting into town.
Yeah, it was fine. Oh, we should do another one. It was rubbish. I got mugged.
There we go.
When I turned up, it was a scam.
That's it. We'll record both versions of the story, and then whichever one is, you tell me after.
Yeah, you choose the one that's right.
Choose your own award. Did you have those books as a kid? We had those Choose Your Own Adventure books. Did you have those in the UK?
Which publisher was it?
Oh, geez, I have no idea. I can't remember that. I worked in a bookstore for years, but they had these books, and they were adventure books. And then you would read a chapter, and it would say, "Now, which direction should the story go, A or B?" And then you would jump to that chapter. We called them Choose Your Own Adventure.
Sorry. Wow.
Yeah. Anyways. Mm. Well, Ben, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate you stepping up and taking time out of your day to give us an update on your Defender rebuild, Tribute rebuild. I think it's important we throw a Tribute in there. I think that's really cool. I'm glad you're doing it. Glad somebody's doing it. And you know, it's not the 2 millionth Defender, but it's your Defender, and you're keeping it on the road, which is fantastic. So. Thanks for joining us today. And of course, in the show notes, we'll have a link to funrover.com, but that's the place to go. And then I think you have a link there to your YouTube channel, or is it just is Funrover the YouTube channel?
The YouTube channel is funrover.com, but the word dot. It was a really bad decision. so, yeah, I don't think I could get just Funrover, but there's links on there anyway. Once you go to the website, you can find it. And you can also read sort of more detailed job lists and pictures and what have you. So, yeah.
Great. So it's funrover.com with dot spelled out.
That's the YouTube channel.
That's the YouTube channel. Yeah. Right. And then, yeah. But I'll hopefully get all that in the show notes. So if anybody don't fully understand the links, they'll be there on the show notes. Great. Well, thanks again, Ben.
No worries.
Good luck. And we'll follow you on your YouTube channel and we'll see how things go. So hopefully it turns out well for you. And please come back to the show after it's done. And maybe after you move to Ireland or before, whenever. You know, we'll work it out.
Cool.
Cool.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
You're quite welcome.
The following is a promo for one of our sister shows on the 4x4 Radio Network. Can you guess which one?
On this week's talk show, we hear about FCA threatening to build a new crossover. An Australian man has gone viral with his lemon song. And on Wrangler Talk, I talk about my research for choosing a lip kit for my JKU.
Tammy talks about a contest to win a Jeep sticker. We play your voicemails and answer some tech questions about suspension and tire clearance. Anton stops by and talks about his CJ build.
In our latest tech segment, we talk about Lipton tire size options on the JKUs. I have a little show and tell. And in Radio ComTech, John talks about APRS. It's all coming up on the talk show.
So this brings us to a close of the 32nd edition of the Center Steer podcast, with Morgan being unavailable for work purposes as our Heritage contributor. We're not going to have a Heritage segment this month, but that's okay. You can have the time to go out and enjoy yourself in your own Land Rover.
Heritage or no.
And actually, we want you to use that time that normally that Morgan would talk about Heritage to think about your own Heritage. Coming up in December, as we've mentioned several times, the Defender is coming to the end of its 67-year run. And I know Defender, I put that in quotes because, you know, we all realize that there's this continuous line from the series to the Defender. And, you know,
the lineage of the Defender.
The lineage, that's a good way. So we want to have a contest, non-contest. We have nothing to give away.
A non-competitive competition.
Yes. So what do you, listener, if price was no object, and if there was no legal restrictions, and time was not an option, from 1948 to 2015, which Land Rover would you choose to have in your own driveway? And we want you to be specific. If it's a Range Rover, is it a Range Rover Classic? And what color was it? What transmission would be in it? If it's a Disco, is it Disco 1, 2, or 3, or 4, or 5? Well, there's no 5 yet. Would it be an automatic? Would it be diesel? Would it be gasoline? Would it be a G4 edition? So we're looking for, you know, being very specific. And if you have an interesting story, we want to hear that too. And this is a contest, non-contest.
It doesn't even have to be a wish list, if you will. It could be if you've had one that's been very standout.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that would be interesting to hear about. We want to hear about it. And so,
if you've already had one that you think is the ultimate Rover, we want to hear about it.
And we are going to do our best to read all of them on the podcast next month when we have our December recording. And if any of them sound really interesting, we might even invite you onto the show. Please go out to our Facebook page, post out there on the Facebook page, or go to our website and give us an email, or even tweet us at Center Steer on the Twitter. And we want to hear about your stories. We want to hear what your vehicle of choice would be, again, if money was no object, time was not a factor, and legal restrictions, especially here in the United States, was not a consideration. Because I know Harold would, what you would take, as we heard earlier, you'd want to have the current Heritage Edition, right?
I might, yeah. I don't know. I think some of the stuff that Special Vehicles put out back in the 70s were really cool. Some of the one-off stuff they did for commercial use.
Also, we're including one-off. I guess, well, based on our
of course we are.
Based on our short set of criteria for the contest non-contest, I guess you could choose the one-offs, right?
They're one-offs, 10-offs, 20-offs. Yeah,
that's true. Yeah. I think
Special Vehicles is not off the table.
Wow, that's true. So you could do that cool one that they made that goes on the water that has the pontoons. I don't know what that was called.
The civilian or the military version? Which one?
See, there we go. Well, so you need to...
The APGP.
And then there's that nifty one that they made just for the Forestry Service.
With those monster tires?
Yeah.
The Land Rover monster tires.
Yeah,
see, here we go. This is what I'm talking about. It could be anything.
Well, you might need to go out and check Graham Aldous's 60... What do you call it? 65? Was that the DVD he made when he went to Land Rover headquarters, and he made that DVD of all of the... that they had assembled all those Land Rovers. There was the fire truck. There was the current model Range Rovers. There was Defenders. There were Freelanders. There was everything. And he did that 65. It was for the 65th anniversary of Land Rover.
Right.
So that's a good... That'd be a good starting point to see... see what's out there and what's available. So we want to hear from you. So as I said, go out to Facebook, go out to Twitter, go out to email. And those are the big three. G+, Google Plus seems to have died, but it's still out there. You could probably try to contact us there. And let us know, what would you like to see? And then, as I said, we will do our best to read them all on the air next month. And since it's not a contest, enter as many times as you like. And we have nothing to send you. There's no prize.
other than pride. And
yes, and interestingness.
Unless you consider maybe being invited to be on our show as some sort of a win.
That's true. That's true. There are I know there are people have contacted me and mentioned that they listen as they commute, and that might be odd for them to hear themselves on the air as they're commuting at some point in the future, right?
Quite possibly. But
yeah, who knows?
But feel free to enter as many times as you like. You don't have to choose only one rover. If money were no object, you can have several.
What would you take? Do you have any thoughts? Can you give our listeners some examples?
Again, I can't choose just one, and I've mentioned a few here, but
Well, I know you've always been partial to that Range Rover that had the free supply of whiskey.
The Holland & Holland edition with the whiskey replenishment policy.
That would be cool. Yes. So how did that work?
Well, I mean, it was produced with Holland & Holland, the big sporting manufacturer. And it came with gun cabinets and actually had a bar in back. And actually, yeah, Land Rover would replenish your whiskey dispensers. And when they run low, someone would come out and refill them.
Just one kind of whiskey? How did they know?
I suspect someone had to notify them, but I think it was limited to the period of the warranty of the vehicle or something like that. But I don't remember the actual nuts and bolts of how you got your thing replenished, but it was part of the deal.
When did they do this? Is this like in the 90s or something?
Late 90s. I think it was a P-38-based vehicle.
Okay. Yeah, I remember seeing a picture of that. Seems about right. There you go. So
pretty much every time it was in for service, you'd get your whiskey topped up.
So pretty much every week.
So, yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, that's the reason you had the whiskey, right?
Well, yeah. It helps the ownership experience.
There we go.
Something to do while it's in the shop. Or on the side of the road.
Or on the side of the road while you're waiting for the tow truck to show up. Yeah, and you're yelling at Land Rover North America because your Range Rover has died again, right?
Yeah, something like that.
So thanks again for listening to the 32nd edition of the Center Steer podcast. We really appreciate it. Take a few minutes, if you don't mind, also while you're commenting about what ultimate Land Rover you would like, to go out to iTunes and give us a review. It helps to move us up in the rankings so that others can discover the podcast, and gives us some feedback, too, on hopefully things that you like. Maybe there's something you don't like. Then we can maybe try to adjust how things are going for the podcast. And also in this time is a good opportunity to share the podcast with other Land Rover friends that you may have. Let them know we're out here and to where to go to listen in. And I want to thank you for that in advance for letting other people know about the show. We'll come back in a month-ish, and we'll hopefully have a lot of submissions for the for everybody's personal ultimate Land Rover that they would like without restriction. There we go. I like that. The without restriction contest, non-contest. Hey, thanks very much, everybody, for listening to the 32nd edition. We'll talk to you in another month about all things.
The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Traitors, is available from Nivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.nivio.com.
I apologize if I waffled on, but it's not often you get someone say, "Tell me about your Land Rover." Most people are kind of like, "He's on about his Land Rover again. Very good."
Yes, this is the only, and it's true, this is the only place we will not want about you talking about your Land Rover.